I'm talking today with Associate Professor Andrew McIsaac, who, apart from being Director of Cardiology here at St Vincent's in Melbourne, is also President of the Cardiac Society of Australia and New Zealand. Thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure. Nice to talk to you.
You have written a very comprehensive editorial for our upcoming cardiology issue, which is coming out on the 1st of August, I believe. This issue coming up has got new guidelines for the treatment of acute coronary syndromes. Tell us a little bit about mortality rates and why the guidelines needed a revision.
So myocardial infarction, acute coronary syndromes, remains a major cause of morbidity and mortality in our community and is clearly one of the leading causes of death. We've also made tremendous strides in the last 20 to 30 years in the treatment of these conditions, and outcomes have improved significantly. So it's very important that patients get appropriate treatment, because it really does make a big difference to their long-term outcome and their chance of dying.
Yep.
There's still significant mortality and morbidity from acute coronary syndrome. If you have a heart attack in Australia today, your chance of dying during your hospital admission is 4.5% according to the snapshot registry. Another 5.1% of patients have a recurrent myocardial infarction during that admission. But it's not only the in-hospital death rate, it's what happens during follow-up. And at 18 months, about 16% of patients with both ST elevation and non-ST elevation myocardial infarctions die, and about 6.8% of patients who present with acute coronary syndromes die by 18 months. So these are really big numbers that can hopefully be improved significantly, and the guidelines are aimed at improving the outcome of these patients by putting forward the recommended treatments, systems and protocols to treat these patients.
And what are some of the revisions that have been made?
Well, some of the revisions that have been made to try and simplify how to treat someone coming in with a heart attack. We've always been aware that the sooner people are treated after the onset of a heart attack, the better their outcome. I suppose in the more recent era of treatment, many of these patients have been taken directly to cardiac cath labs and had what's called a primary PCI, or percutaneous coronary intervention, and the arteries open and stented. Of course, not all hospitals have the facilities to provide that. There's been debate about whether patients should be shipped to these hospitals or not, or whether they should be treated with thrombolytic therapy, which is the alternative, early on in the local hospital. There were confusing guidelines about the timing and how this should be done. These have been clarified, and I think this will make it much easier to set up appropriate systems of care.
So what's the timeline now?
We want to have people treated within 90 minutes of presenting to a hospital with a cardiac cath lab, or thrombolyzed in a similar time. As long as they're within the first 12 hours of the onset of their symptoms, but clearly the quicker they go, the better.
Yep.
The other thing that we've had to take into account is that there are new forms of treatment available, and there are, in the journal, there was another article about hospital-administered thrombolysis and actually treating people before they get to hospital with thrombolysis. And the outcomes of this have been very promising indeed, and we need some more research to compare that to waiting to go to a hospital and having a stenting procedure. But I think, especially in rural and regional areas where we're a little bit remote, having early thrombolysis administered by the ambulance service is extremely promising, and will probably save a significant number of lives and reduce morbidity.
When is it appropriate to stent a patient who is stable?
Well, patients with stable coronary artery disease, there's also been advances in our understanding of the role of stenting in these patients. It's clear from many large trials that stenting patients with stable angina is aimed at relieving their symptoms and aimed at relieving myocardial ischemia. Traditionally, cardiologists looked at coronary angiograms and made an objective assessment of how severe the narrowing was and whether it was bad enough to warrant stenting. We've now learnt that there's great variation in cardiologists' assessment of lesions, and one cardiologist may say something severe and needs a stent, another cardiologist may say it's not so bad.
Yep.
And there's been a lot of work looking at correlating this with the presence of ischemia in the myocardium.
Right.
And there's this new technique, relatively new technique, called using a special pressure wire put down the coronary artery called the fractional flow reserve, which is an assessment of the perfusion of the myocardium.
Right.
And it's been shown that if you treat patients according to this very objective measure of how significant a lesion is, that you can really improve patient outcomes and better target stenting. So often patients with stable angina, it's very important to be guided by some sort of stress test to see whether there's ischemia in the heart and which lesion is causing that ischemia. Or now on the cath lab table, you can use the FFR wire.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why that article is in the MJA, looking at the uptake of this new technology, which has been used increasingly in the Australian cardiological world to improve the targeting of treatment.
Would you like to see it used more?
Well, I think that it does need to be used more. Mm-hmm. We probably need better assessment of who's going to benefit from stenting beyond just a subjective assessment of the coronary angiogram by the cardiologist.
Mm-hmm.
I think all the literature has indicated that the role of stenting in stable angina is to relieve angina, to relieve symptoms, and that it does this best when the lesion is significant, decreasing perfusion measured by FFR, or causing more than 10% of the heart muscle, the myocardium, to be ischemic on a stress test.
Secondary prevention. There are new technologies available. There's a low percentage of people who take up rehab in the way that you'd like, and there are very few who see it all the way through.
Yes.
What technologies are available now, and are they going to be useful in getting people to keep in their rehab?
Well, I think there's a clear challenge in getting all patients to undergo cardiac rehab, a challenge in maintaining patients on medications that are clearly going to improve their outcome,
mm-hmm.
such as aspirin and other antiplatelet agents, all the statins to lower your cholesterol, and ACE inhibitors or angiotensin II receptor blockers that have also been shown to improve prognosis. We know many patients don't like taking tablets, especially if they feel well. An important role in cardiac rehab is to make sure people understand the importance of secondary prevention in doing that. We also need people to understand they need to modify their lifestyles, stop smoking, alter their diet, and exercise more with the aim of having a balanced diet and maintaining their ideal body weight. Cardiac rehab plays a really important role in getting these messages across. Some people don't want to hear these messages, whether that's why they don't go to cardiac rehab. Also, there are funding issues in the Australian healthcare system about who's funding cardiac rehabilitation. It sort of falls after hospitals, not necessarily funded by hospitals. If you've got private insurance, it might be funded, but if you're a public patient, who's going to fund it for you?
Yeah.
And then we have lots of people in Australia who live in remote and regional areas that might be some distance away from their cardiac rehab program. So the use of apps, iPhone technology, may be very beneficial in delivering these messages to people, and video conferencing may also be a way. There have been data, I'm not an expert in mega data, but we hear this word all the time, tracking patient populations from where their iPhones go, seeing how often people do go to the gym versus how often do they go to the fast food outlet. All this information is all being collected.
Yeah.
It may overcome some of these obstacles. I think there's a lot of promise, but we're not at the point yet of saying that traditional cardiac rehab programs can be replaced by these technologies, but I'm hopeful they'll at least supplement it.
Yep.
They might improve it. Maybe they'll prove disruptive, but I think they'll probably be more complementary. But whatever the outcome, we need to do better as a community in providing cardiac rehab to our patients.
You also mentioned the role of registries. How important are they in terms of getting this data for a start? Mm-hmm. And measuring how we're going.
Well, I think really the assessment of the outcomes of patients is key. You can look at individual patients and be quite misled about how good a job you're doing at treating your patients well. It's only by a systematic collection of data that the community can be reassured that their healthcare dollars are being spent well, that technology is being used well and applied well, and our outcomes are good. And it's only through these registries that collect the outcome of data that we can identify system problems that we have, not with the aim of being punitive about an individual doctor or hospital, but to understand that our healthcare system is not ideal and can always be improved, and we might need better systems in place to either monitor, transfer patients, or deliver various treatments. I think that it's essential, and the Cardiac Society has really pushed very hard to establish registries of the outcomes of patients. The snapshot, which was a paper, which was in the MJA a few years ago, demonstrated the outcomes of nearly every patient having acute coronary syndrome in Australia and New Zealand over a two-week period. There was so much data collected. We identified so many issues that need to be addressed. This needs to be done on an ongoing basis with feedback to the doctors, the administrators, and to patients to understand how our outcomes can be improved. We don't know that we are delivering optimal, cost-effective treatment unless we can monitor our outcomes. The problem is we have a system that's very good, or pretty good, or by world-class excellent, I suppose, in paying for healthcare.
Yes.
Who's paying to monitor the outcomes, and how do we do that? Professional societies have done it. Some states in some areas have done it. The federal government's done it. But it's always a struggle, and we need a proper system put in place for registries about cardiac outcomes, but probably registries about many different important areas to improve our outcomes.
I think at one point, just to read a quote, you say it's incumbent on the cardiac community to get involved in these issues. Is the cardiac community not involved enough?
Well, I think the cardiac community is very involved. We have a lot of people who want to get these outcomes and establish registries, but there are also people who, you know, like everything in life, would like to leave it to someone else to do it. And I don't think there's any people very opposed to it, but often people are time poor. The other thing is that we need to make sure that we have a common theme and a common direction, and that we don't, in a federated country, that we don't get bogged down in regional and state-based issues and issues of who controls it and who's running it. It needs to be open and transparent so the doctors have confidence in it and health professionals have confidence in it and have some ownership of it. It needs, but not to the exclusion, you know, where it's seen to be one individual or one group sort of adventure. So we need to make sure sometimes in society there rise a bit of tension about who's going to do things, but there's a lot of goodwill in the cardiology community to do this. And my really call in the editorial was to galvanise people to try and translate that goodwill into action, and for people to advocate their local hospitals and their local healthcare networks and the healthcare funders that this is a really essential activity.
Thank you for your time.
It's a pleasure.